Hi and welcome. I am your host, Emma Gunnar-Wardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. Joining me in this episode of the podcast is Gillian Lavender. Gillian is one of the founders of the London Meditation Centre, where she teaches Vedic meditation, a type of meditation that uses a mantra to quiet the mind and allow the body to access deep, deep rest. I first heard about the London Meditation Centre a few years ago, actually, maybe five or six, when I was told that meditation could be a useful tool to help me with the feelings of anxiety I was struggling with at the time. They had reached a peak and felt debilitating at times. And if you've ever experienced anything like it, you will understand why I wanted out and I was open to anything that could help. And I was told that meditation was really effective and efficient and was a really sensible route for me to take. So I looked at the course, but at the time it was cost prohibitive and I couldn't invest. So instead, I leaned into and found some support from more affordable, accessible sources at the time, like meditation apps. And at the time, it was mainly Headspace. However, the lovely Amelia Freer, the incredible nutritionist and author and just all-round wonderful woman, mentioned that she had done Gillian's course. The centre was run by Gillian and her partner, Michael. And when she came on the Feel Good Habits podcast, she said how wonderful the benefits were and how it had been transformative. And actually, that's the word that comes up time and time again when you speak to people who've done the training with Gillian or Michael. They say it's transformative, that those courses just change your life. So once again, my interest was piqued. And I had used the app successfully for a while, but I'd become inconsistent and then I hadn't really used them very much. And every time I tried to go back, it just didn't feel the same. It felt like putting the wrong key in the wrong lock. It just was like, something's not right here. So it had felt inaccessible for quite a while. And for that reason, I'd actually kind of given up on meditation proper, as it were, the daily practice that's pretty solitary, and had leaned instead into things like guided meditations. So I've gone to YouTube. There are so many guided meditations on YouTube. Just check the comments and that they're verified accounts before you relax and release yourself into it. But I quite appreciated the fact that I was still letting go, but also that someone else is maybe taking charge and doing the heavy lifting for me. And then not long after Amelia came on the podcast, Gillian very kindly sent me a copy of her book, Why Meditate. And once I picked it up, I read it quickly and easily. And I say once I picked it up, meaning I think long-time listeners know I have quite a big to-be-read pile. And so it can sometimes, and I have to be diligent and put the new books at the bottom, otherwise I will forget things. So I read it quickly and easily and was just convinced. By the last page, I was just like, I've got to speak to Gillian and I've got to do this course. And this is what I wanted, not a quick fix from a guided meditation with no real understanding of what was happening. Although, let's face it, if you've ever done an app meditation or a guided meditation via the internet or wherever, you'll know that you do feel lovely afterwards. It can feel quite yummy, it can feel quite comforting and cozy. But I was really wanting a proven technique that once I'd learned it, I'd always have and could use and do every single day to make those waves of anxiety, to make sure those waves of anxiety would never strike again, and also to deal with a whole plethora of other things. And this is the thing about meditation. The reasons for being drawn towards it are many and varied and so unique and personal to everybody. So for me, it's I don't want to bring stress and anxiety along for the ride every day, which I'm very good at doing. I don't want to ruminate. I want to be less sensitive. But for others, it's to bring down blood pressure or to feel more grounded or to feel more rational, whatever it might be. Every single person has their reasons for wanting to meditate. And like I said, you don't have to have a specific reason to qualify all reasons are valid. And while there are thousands who'll tell you anecdotally the positive impact meditation has had on their lives, there are also reams of data to show that the mind and body do respond to meditation and are affected positively, especially when using a mantra-based meditation like Vedic meditation. So after reading the book, I obviously scrambled to my email and immediately invited Gillian onto the show to explain a little bit more about the process and why it works. And actually, the book is called Why Meditate? And the subtitle is Because It Works. I mean, literally, you could take the cover and take it at face value, go on the course and feel like you had been prompted in the right direction, even though the book is very thorough and delves into those reasons as to why meditate. But it's not a how-to, and you'll hear about this in the episode. So you'll be able to hear, but by the end of this conversation, I am convinced you will hear it. And as such, I signed up for the first course at the centre in January 2022. And it's why, in large part, the first of the 12 habits is meditation. I really wanted to lean into these habits. And what better way than an immersive four-day course where I'd learn a mantra and learn to meditate properly. As for Gillian, I mean, you'll hear her on the show now. She's so lovely and kind and open and generous and warm. And she's been teaching people to meditate for nearly 20 years. Hasten to add, when you're in her class, she has the best laugh. That's just a side observation, a little sneak peek of what you might get if you meet her in person. She's originally from New Zealand and prior to teaching meditation, had a very demanding and busy career in the world of publishing. Maybe this is why I align with her so much. She tried Vedic meditation, felt the difference immediately, and as the saying goes, never look back. She teaches in London, New York, she teaches privately, there are retreats in Portugal and India and much more. And she's also an expert in Ayurvedic medicine and has helped thousands of people feel better via meditation, also by consulting with them on general health, fertility and many, many other issues. So she's a very robust source of information and she gets good information. I'll say that she can quote studies like a pro, and listeners, you know how much I love that. So during our conversation, we discuss a whole host of things, including why we need to meditate in the first place and how it offers an excellent balance, especially in the modern world that we're living in now. The many myths around meditation, what it involves, what it feels like, and so much more. Gillian explains how meditation can help with stress. And here's a clue. It doesn't help you deal with it. It helps you release it and not let it in, which might appeal to many of you. Definitely appeals to me. The way meditation can help in times of overload and overwhelm. How mantras work and how they allow the body to be and achieve such a restful state. Why it's possible to reach a deeper rest during meditation than you do during sleep, which was a real surprise and very glad to hear about it. I'm a fan of breath work, and as long-time listeners will know, I've talked about it a lot. I talked about it with Wim Hof on the show. So I asked Gillian about breath work and yoga and where they fit in and or complement meditation, because there's sort of three things that seem to be talked about together. And this will be a big one for a lot of listeners, I know, but we talk about meditation and how it can help improve your quality of sleep. Now, since this chat, I've done the course, and I can confirm that a week after it, still today marks my week anniversary of being a meditator, I'm sleeping like a log, thank you very much. I am sleeping so deeply, like sleep that I can't remember having before, other than when I was sort of coming around from jet lag, sleeping so deeply. Oh, and one other thing we definitely cover is if you've ever said things like baking/running, crosswords, Real Housewives, walking in the park, I don't know, playing with my kids, whatever, is my meditation, then Gillian's here to tell you that you may want to rethink how you think about meditation, because even though you might feel as though you're in a flow state, you are not necessarily in a meditative state. So anyway, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm going to let Gillian take over. So here's my conversation with the brilliant Gillian Lavender from the London Meditation Centre, and I will put all of the links to Gillian and the centre where you can find all of the information about the course costs, etc. I'll put all of those links in the show notes. But here, please do join me in welcoming the wonderful Gillian Lavender onto The Emma Gunn Show. A very warm welcome to the Emma Gunn Show. Gillian Lavender, how are you?
I'm very well, Emma. Nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you. And I feel very honoured actually to be having this conversation with you, because you're the co-founder of the London New York Meditation Centres. It's about Vedic meditation. You're also an author. I heard about you a little while ago because your friend of mine, Amelia Freer, spoke mm-hmm. so beautifully about the benefits that she had felt from meditation and the techniques that she had learned from you when she came and did the Feel Good Habits podcast. And ever since then, I thought, oh, I want a piece of that action. I want a piece of that. And then I read your book.
She's a great advertisement for this.
Yeah, isn't she? And then I read the book and I thought, actually, this is so what I needed to read because, and I, listeners, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that I've talked about meditation before and how it has helped me previously. I've hit a brick wall and Gillian is going to help me either climb over it or burst through it, aren't you?
We will get through it, absolutely.
Whilst also explaining it is exactly that you do. So would you mind explaining what it is that Vedic meditation is and what it is that you do at your centres?
Of course. So I teach, as you say, Vedic meditation, which is the oldest and the most researched technique that we have on the planet today. Vedic meditation comes from a body of knowledge called the Veda, V-E-D-A, which is in Sanskrit, it means truth or pure knowledge. And it's from where we get Ayurveda. I know many of your listeners will have heard of Ayurveda, yoga, and meditation. And it is a body of knowledge which is about 5 to 10,000 years old. So this is going right back to the essence of what it means to settle down the mind and body and experience the baseline of consciousness of who we are, which is a state of being, because, you know, we're not human thinkings and we're not human doings, we're human beings. And yet we've lost track of that experience over time. And so this knowledge has been around for a while, and it's been revived in about the late 50s and brought out of India, where the knowledge has been preserved, and brought to the West. And now we have millions of people practicing this technique every day. It's a technique that we do sitting in a chair with the eyes closed. And that means, unlike, you know, a Google image of, you know, meditation, where you've got somebody sitting in some pretzel position, you know, with their legs crossed and their back is straight and their hands are doing some mudra and all this. That's not what we do. We just sit comfortably with the back supported. I was meditating on the train the other day. It's great for travel, for planes, trains, automobiles, as long as you're not driving. So you can do this anywhere. This morning I meditated sitting up in bed with the pillows propped up behind me before my daughter woke up and things got going. We do it for 20 minutes in the morning and we do it 20 minutes late afternoon, early evening. When we practice this technique in that 20 minutes, we achieve a level of rest, which is unprecedented. And that's really where the benefits flow, you know, from.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned rest there. And I know that in the book, you talk about the fact that the rest that you can achieve during meditation can be better than the rest that you achieve during sleep, even, especially if your sleep is disrupted, as many of us experience. We're so overstimulated that we're not actually falling into any kind of deep sleep. And the book is called Why Meditate? And then because it works. But that is not the end of the story. Although I did love that title. But it, in the book you explain, it isn't a how to meditate. It is a why. It is going to positively impact so many areas of your life if you do. And I think that's the thing that I didn't necessarily tune into when I first started trying to meditate. I was looking for that fix that would stop me feeling anxious. But actually, the benefits spread far wider than that, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually.
Absolutely. I think, you know, what happens when we meditate is that we come back to our absolute essence, our source. You know, people will sometimes say to me, oh, you know, so is this a spiritual technique? You know, is this spiritual? And it's kind of spiritual in inverted commas, because that kind of has a sometimes negative connotation to it. You know, is this going to be woo-woo? Is this, you know, a bit ooby-gooby? Is this religious? Do I have to believe in something? And in fact, it is a ancient knowledge. However, it doesn't require you to adopt some philosophy or belief system. When I say spiritual, I'm talking about your spirit, and your spirit is your essence. Your essence is consciousness. Everything in the universe is energy. everything. And we know that from quantum field theory, that all this stuff, you know, that we think of as stuff is actually at its baseline energy, including us. So what Vedic meditation is allowing us to do is to come back to our essence, our spirit. And in that sense, yes, it's a spiritual technique. However, it's something that is so practical and so right for us as householders, you know, in the world, relationships, jobs, racing around. This is something that doesn't require us to change our life in any way. So I think it's this really interesting balance. And in our life, as you say, we have so many pressures and people are tired. People are tired, particularly what we've gone through in the last 18 months. And I see this all the time. People come to me and, you know, the very thing they need is rest. And what's the first thing that goes? Their ability to rest. You know, when you're frazzled and you're over, you've got all that cortisol pumping through your system and the adrenal glands are pumping out that norepinephrine, that's stress chemistry. And that is keeping you wired, but tired. So we need to get to the root cause and get rid of all of that.
And it's almost, though, even the way you were describing it then, it's almost if you think of yourself as an orb in the middle of your chest, for example, it seems like modern life is distracting us and making us think further and further away from that. So I'm not suggesting it's gut instinct, but it is almost this disconnection from who you are, what you stand for, what you believe in, how you feel. Is that how it can present?
I think it's a really interesting point that you raised. Somebody, I did an interview the other day and somebody said to me, what's the most important thing that you've got from meditation? Now, I've been meditating for 25 plus years. And I sort of had to take a moment, like, okay, the most important thing, what's the one thing? I've got so much from it, of course. And yet, if I my response to her was, the biggest thing that I have gained from this is the ability to trust myself, to trust my sense, I call it my fine level of feeling. We all have that gut feel, that intuition. It's there. But what happens is that it gets obstructed and we lose contact with it because of all these layers, like layers on an onion of stress and tension and, you know, toxins and all the stuff. And the legacy of that and fatigue means that we lose connection to that fine level of feeling. What meditation's doing is it's peeling away those layers. And so for me, that ability to enliven my sense of my own self, my sense of what feels right for me in this moment, not what some magazine is telling me, not what some influencer is telling me, not what my mum says, but what I feel. Yeah. And you're right. Our society is throwing all sorts of this and do this and buy this and, you know, pulling our senses out. And what meditation is doing is it's allowing us to de-excite, and come back to that baseline of who we are. And when you have contact with that, you can start to reliably draw down upon that and trust it. And so then we have this sense, as one of my students said, I feel grounded in a way. I feel like I've come home in a way. I feel like me in a way that I just haven't felt like for years. And I think, you know, that was really, when I thought about it, one of the most important things, because at the end of the day, only you know what's best for you. And we have to trust ourselves. And how do we do that when we're out of balance and we're out of kilter and we're exhausted and we're frazzled and we've been making a mistake? You know, we did try this and it didn't work, and then we lose confidence. And so then we go here and it's like we're bumbling around in the fog, trying to sort of do what we think is right, what our intellect tells us is right. And we've totally disconnected from that fine level of feeling or that gut feel. So meditation reconnects us with that by removing the obstacles to us experiencing that 24/7.
I wonder if there's anyone else listening and having the same thought that I'm having, which is, I really want it, but I can't seem to get there. And that, I guess you cover a lot of myths in the book, but that is one of the things, isn't it? That it's really hard to do. And it's a challenge to access, and it requires a lot of focus and attention to actually access what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, in the book, I talk about firstly what meditation is not. And a lot of these ideas that are really deeply ingrained, you say to people, or, you know, meditation, well, that means I have to stop thinking, right? You know, I have to get, you know, kind of concentrate and focus and clear away all these thoughts and just sort of, you know, get to some place of, you know, lovely zenny nothingness or something. Or, you know, I'm just not going to have time. I'm not going to be able to settle down. I'm like Ricochet Rabbit. How am I actually going to sit still for 20 minutes? You know, many people come to me and they'll say, well, you know, have you ever had anybody that hasn't been able to do this? Because, you know, I know you're talking about all this stuff. It sounds fantastic, but, you know, you don't know my mind. You know, I'm like all over the place. And I think, you know, that was part of why I wrote the book, because it's great. You know, I've been teaching this now for coming up on 2 decades. And when I first started teaching, it was like pushing on a closed door. Meditation, mental health, stress, these were not things that were in the mainstream in the way that they are now. And that's fantastic. And with that comes some confusion and some dilution of really what everything is about. And so meditation is not an does not need to be an experience of focus, focus, focus. There are different approaches. And in the book, I talk about there are some styles of meditation that do say, right, focus on this, concentrate on the candle flame, and don't try not to think. The experience that I have with this and that my students report is that that's really hard work. The moment you say to the mind, don't think, if I say to you, okay, Emma, don't think, you know, the moment you prohibit something in life, the thing that you're prohibiting gets stronger. It's very difficult. It's not how the mind works. Then we have this other category, which is open monitoring awareness or mindfulness, where we're monitoring our thinking. Oh, I can feel the, you know, I'm really trying to tune into the present moment. Like, you know, the classic doing the dishes, you know, I'm being mindful. I can feel the water, you know, the mind is engaged. And then there's this third category of Vedic meditation, which is an automatic self-transcending technique, which is very different and doesn't involve any effort and is a process of stepping beyond thought. And this is an experience that when people have it, when they know how to do that, and that's my job is to teach people that, they're like, oh my gosh, this is easy. I'm thinking of a woman who came to me a few years ago now. She said, look, I'm a bit of an old hippie. You know, you name it, I've done it. She was 69. Her daughter had learned to meditate and she'd seen such a change in her daughter. She thought, I'm going to check this out. And, you know, to her credit, she was this incredibly open and curious woman. She was a yoga teacher. And I remember her face. She came out of that first meditation with me and she was like, it was like tears. She was like, this is easy. And all the stuff that she'd been doing for decades had required effort and it had required her to be trying to think of something or not think of something and leaving the mind sort of straining. In Vedic meditation and this transcending technique, we want to work with the nature of the mind. And that means give it something that it likes. And in the case of Vedic meditation, we teach you a mantra, a sound. And that sound is really delicious for the mind. It's yummy. We don't chant it. We don't speak it out. We think it silently. So the other day when I was sitting on the train, I had my eyes closed. I was thinking my mantra. The mantra automatically built into that meaningless sound, that pulsation of sound, is this ability to become fainter and fainter. And the mind just loves those quiet, settled layers, those stratum of the mind that is so delicious. And it just follows the mantra as it gets fainter and fainter. I'm not doing anything as a meditator. The mantra is doing it for me. And then the mantra is almost gone and then it disappears and the mind falls mute. It falls quiet. And we drop into that inner blissful state of contentedness, that state of being, that state which is beyond thought. And when we know how to do that, it is automatic. It is easy peasy. It doesn't require any effort. And that's the thing that we find in life. You know, when you work with nature, things flow. When you go against nature, you come up against all sorts of obstacles and friction. In Vedic meditation, when we know how to do this, we work with the nature of the mind. the whole thing flows. And so people who have tried other stuff, as many people have, will come to me and they'll say, this is completely different. And it starts to reveal these changes so quickly.
I mean, you couldn't have sold it any better. I want my mind to go mute. And I think that's the thing. So just taking a few steps back, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this, and I'm sure you have experienced this. And please, before I say what I'm about to say, I'm not bashing apps. I'm certainly not saying anything negative about anything out there that is promoting or helping people meditate. But I used meditation apps for a little while and I definitely felt some benefit. But yeah, it was almost as if, it was almost that thing of when you go to the gym for a prolonged period of time, you get results and you think, yeah, great. And then you kind of take your foot off the gas and then you're back to square one again. And every time I've tried to go back into the apps, it just doesn't fit anymore. It feels clunky. And whenever I'm given that sort of 6 minute period to quiet in my mind, I just fall asleep. And I observed in the book, you do say that that is quite common. People come to you and say, I've already made some progress, but I want to take it to the next level. And so if someone's listening to this and they have tried before and they have felt smatterings of benefits, how can they move forward and access what you've just described, which is very tantalizing?
Yeah. I like you, you know, have an approach where everything has value, and many people come these days having, because the entry point into an app is pretty easy, you know, not many barriers to entry. You know, I've got my phone, I'll log onto this thing and I'll have an experience which probably delivers some sort of level of contrast to the manic kind of stressy, busy, overdoing, overthinking kind of state that they were in. And here's somebody settling me down and guiding the mind, and the mind is engaged in some thinking, but it's more settled and I can feel my body sort of settling, maybe my breathing settling a bit. It's okay for a bit, and it reaches a certain level and I have an experience. I think, okay. And, you know, maybe I do that again and I have it a few times. And then what happens? Well, I notice I'm not sticking with it. It's not something that I feel drawn to do every day. I'm not looking forward to it necessarily. It becomes another thing on my list. Oh gosh, I should meditate. I know it's really good for me. You know, everybody else is doing it and Jerry Seinfeld does it and, you know, I better do it. And, you know, it's Hugh Jackman does it. Okay, right.
I don't want to break my streak. That's the thing that kind of got me with meditation streaks.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that doesn't seem very meditative.
Yeah. So we get kind of acquisitive about it, you know, right. I'm on it. But you know, as one of my students said to me, he said, I was doing it to help me get to sleep. And he said, everything that I learned about sleep hygiene was do not have your phone right next to you when you are going to sleep. And he said, but then I had to have my phone there in order for this guy to talk me into getting to sleep. You know, he said the whole thing was felt off. You know, I think that apps have a place on that journey of moving us along the track, as it were, you know. All the work that we do and the work that you so beautifully promote in your show is about us learning and developing and evolving and upgrading. And there are so many different ways that we can do that. So if somebody has had an experience of an app, I say, great, you know, that's a stepping stone. My watch out is, or the thing to be aware of is, do not think that that is it. You're on the path, you're having an experience. Don't bail at that point. There's more that can be experienced. It's getting you moving in a direction, but it hasn't quite landed. And so then I would say, come along to one of our free introductory talks on Zoom. Listen to us, understand a bit more, keep doing some research about this, get the book, you know, start to understand that this is a process. This will be the most important personal development tool that you learn, learning to meditate. I'm really clear about it. And everything that you've done up to this point has some value. Even those things that we might look back on and say, oh, well, that wasn't so great, or that didn't work. Well, that's research. You've done that research. You can tick that box, you know, and move forward. We don't want to beat ourselves up about these things that we've done. Everything that we're doing is absolutely the best that we can do in that state of consciousness in that moment. And let's stay present and let's keep moving. So yeah, apps have a place maybe to get people on that path. I just don't want them to think that that's sort of the end game and, oh, that didn't work for me, therefore I'm no good at meditation, or I've tried it, doesn't work for me, I'll try something else. Keep moving, you know. Mm-hmm. And there is more to this, and it's a starting point. And anytime somebody sits, you know, I watched somebody the other day, they got on the train and everybody else, 9 out of 10 people, were on their phone. And this person just sat, and I could see she was pretty tired. She just sat and she closed her eyes and she just sat there and she didn't do anything. I was like, okay, that's a positive experience, you know, because rather than being glued to a screen and stimulating the nervous system even more, just let's push pause on that for a moment.
Yeah, because I think in modern culture or modern living, we think actually that sitting down and just doing nothing in front of a streaming service is unwinding, but it's highly stimulating, depending on what you're watching, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the evening. So let's get over, before we dig into the machinations a bit more, let's just get over one of the big hurdles. I'm sure a lot of people will be thinking, I don't have 20 minutes in the morning, and I certainly don't have 20 minutes in the evening. But as you know, actually, it's quite simple to factor it into your day. I mean, that's your experience, not just your own, but with many, 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 many people who've been through your centers.
Yeah. I mean, we've taught thousands and thousands of people to meditate, and they're all busy and they've got kids or they've got businesses, they travel, they've all sorts of stuff going on, studying, whatever it is. 20 minutes is not that long. You know, that's a bit of faffing around on Instagram. That's, you know, an email, that's gone. And, you know, I get it. When I first went along to an introductory talk about meditation all that time ago, I went into a mild state of panic when I heard that I was going to be, you know, two lots of 20 minutes. I was like, what? Because I always felt like I was chasing time. I always felt like I never had enough time. And when we're in that state, I was a stress bag, you know, I was really stressed. You know, everything is racing. The body is racing. Everything, blood pressure, heart rate, you know, the biochemistry of the body is all hyper. So, yeah, I was like, what? 20 minutes twice a day. And actually, what I found is that when I invested the 20 minutes time and I sat down and I did my meditation, I came out feeling more grounded and calmer and clearer. And everything that I did subsequent to meditation was better and more effective and more efficient. And I just was able to focus. I didn't have to read that paragraph 5 times before I got it. You know, it sunk in. So what I found and what our students find is that you actually gain time. I know this sounds kind of wonky, but by putting that 20 minutes into your day, you are able to, you have a spaciousness there, a clarity that means that you are able to, and this was a big thing for me, you know, I had found myself obsessing about certain things and procrastinating and putting some things off. And what I found when I started meditating was actually, you know, those things I had been obsessing about, they weren't even my business. You know, that should be on someone else's list. And then I started, you know, putting my attention on the stuff that I had been putting off, or even seeing other stuff that I hadn't really clocked as being the most relevant, important, urgent thing for me to be doing. As one of my students said, I don't have time not to meditate. You know, this is so important for me because I am so much better at everything I do having invested that time. And because I can do it on my commute, or I can do it, you know, at the bookstore, sitting on that quiet chair in the corner, or I can, you know, one of my students said she's been meditating in the lobby of a hotel. She'll just sit in there, you know. And I was meditating in a cafe the other day. I just sat and I put my things in and I closed my eyes. I had a cup of something in front of me, sat and did my meditation. So you can fit this in. And the thing about this is, people say, I can't wait to meditate. You know, I know how yummy this feels. And I feel so much different when I do it. It's like, you know, you sit down late afternoon, early evening. We don't want to meditate too late at night because that wakes us up. We get so much energy. As you said earlier, we're resting about five times deeper than sleep in that 20 minute sitting of meditation. So if you meditate at 11 o'clock at night, you know, you're going to wake up and it's 2 a.m. and you've got all these great ideas and you've got no one to talk to about them. You know, it's like everyone else is asleep. So we don't use it as a getting to sleep kind of tool in that way.
That's so interesting, actually, because I think I've definitely previously thought meditating before bed will be helpful. But the other thing is this coming down from like waking up at a nine. So let's talk about being in an anxious state or oversensitized state, in that I definitely know back in the day when I was really struggling with anxiety, when I woke up, I was ready to fight. I was just ready and on red alert, and anything that happened, I would be reactive because I was already so hyper and so at that kind of nearly a 10. And so it's the practice, isn't it, as well? Like, you might get the immediate benefits. I mean, do you get immediate benefits from the first session?
I have never had anybody who has taken the course with me, and the course is over four consecutive days and it's about 2 hours each day. I have never had anybody who has not noticed something in those first 4 days.
Wow.
So this is not something that I have to sort of do for 6 months before I kind of nail it and before I start to notice a change. So I do want to preface that, though. One of the things that people often notice when they first learn to meditate is sort of waves of fatigue. And it's a bit like, you know, we're all making the sprint to the end of the year and everybody's sort of running around and it's all buy this and get this and wrap this and everything going. And then, you know, let's say they have a moment where they can pause and there's between Christmas and New Year, it's going to be, you know, foot off the pedal and we'll just sort of, you know, go a bit easier. And what happens? Oh, you know, I come down with a cold or I just want to sleep for the first 2 days. And there's the body having been in that hyper state that you described at number nine, where the body is the funding mechanism for all the activity is stress chemistry. And then we take the foot off the pedal and then the body goes, oh, finally, and starts to eject some of the things that have not been able to be removed, like you know, something in the body that didn't get to heal properly. So then we come down with that sore throat and we, you know, we want to be in bed, or we're just all that fatigue that finally comes out. So, you know, yes, we will start to notice changes quickly. And one of the things that we'll know is that fatigue is being released very quickly. So this is why people often say when they learn to meditate, "Ooh, I'm feeling a bit tired these first few days. I'm kind of wiped out," because we're peeling away the excitation chemistry, and sitting right underneath is all of that fatigue that hasn't been able to be released from the system. So yeah, we'll notice changes quickly. This is not something, and you know, we move through that and then we start to notice, oh, I meditate in the afternoon after a really busy day and it's like a shot in the arm. I come out and it's like, oh, now I'm ready for the next part of my day. Meditation will give you energy. Meditation, that deep rest, is going to enliven you and nourish you and make you more balanced. And so you're going to notice the effect of it when you do it. And there is a compounding strategic impact of this. You do this every day. You are getting ahead of the game. You're releasing stress and fatigue faster than you're adding it into your system. That's a very interesting calculation, because what that tells you is that that little stockpile of stressiness and toxins and fatigue that you came to meditation with is starting to be eroded faster than you are adding to it. And that's what moves us through and allows us to reach a state of balance so relatively quickly, actually.
One of the types of meditation, or I don't know if it's a type of meditation actually, but dear friends of mine have been meditating for a long, long time. And a few weeks ago, I got an email saying, oh, I was meditating and you came across my field of vision. And again, Gillian, I'm just like, I want that, because that's not what I was experiencing when I was meditating before. I was just experiencing like breathing slowly and feeling a bit more chilled out. What I wasn't feeling was this connection with consciousness and with the people that I cared about. And that is what appeals to me about learning something like Vedic meditation, because it does seem as though it isn't just about the physical calming that you get. It's about, it seems as though, from what people tell me, there is an awakening.
Yes, there is this terminology that we will have heard called self-realization. We will have heard this in all the spiritual texts. We want to realize the self. It's a moment of, there are many different ways to describe this, you know, enlightenment, you know, coming to our center, all sorts of ways, experiencing, as I said earlier, the essence of who we are. And the analogy I would use for this is to think about a wave on an ocean. So you're a wave, I'm a wave, everything's a wave, a fluctuation of energy, because actually that is what is the baseline for the universe. It's all energy. It's all configurations and arrangements of energy. So there's my wave, and I'm starting to meditate Vedic meditation. So what am I doing? I'm favoring a very simple pulsation of sound that's been chosen for me by my teacher, has a particular vibrational quality that resonates with me. So there I am, silently thinking my mantra. Now what's happening?
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My individual wave on that ocean of consciousness is starting to settle down and broadening out. And the mantra is getting fainter and fainter and fainter and fainter and fainter. It's almost gone, almost. And then it disappears. And there's that moment of flop, of complete symmetry. My individuality has settled into that baseline of consciousness. That's that moment that we talk about of being. Experiencing small self, little s, realizing big self, capital S, self-realization. That baseline of consciousness is a reservoir of energy, creative potential, the source of all your thoughts, the source of everything in the universe, blissful. And then what we notice in meditation is, oh, I'm back out into thinking again, because the body is releasing some stress and that pulls me back up to the surface, and then back to the mantra, and we settle down. Now, in a 20-minute sitting of meditation, this process of small self identifying with big self is happening all the time, whether we know it or not. And it's that grounding effect. You know, it's that sense of what you're looking for of, well, I want that foundation to be strong and stable, and I want to feel connected to who I am. And that is what is happening every time you practice this technique.
So it's not just a case of you say the mantra, it gets quieter and your mind goes on mute. You do have to pull it back. It is, because they say it, that.
it will automatically, because there's the mind in that super settled state. So as is the mind, so is the body. You are what you think. So somebody sitting over there having anxious, panicky attacks coming on, the neurotransmitters, these are the neurohormones, start flooding the cells of the body. What's the message? Fear, panic, terror. So the body mobilizes. The body starts to print that out. So the acid balance in the tummy changes and the cortisol levels go up and the norepinephrine from the adrenals starts pumping through. All that's happening in a heartbeat because anxious mind, anxious body. In Vedic meditation, settled mind, settled body, deeply, deeply rested, unprecedented. So what do bodies do when they rest? You know, as you intimated earlier, you know, resting kind of gets a bad rap, but resting is really valuable when you know how to do it, because it's the thing that funds everything that comes after it. It's the funding mechanism for everything that you do. So when the mind is deeply rested, the body gets to that profound level of de-excitation. What do bodies do? They heal, they purify, they release stress, they release fatigue. That activity pulls the mind back up for a moment, and then we just come back to the mantra and settle down. So this interplay is happening many, many times in a 20-minute sitting of meditation. I, as a meditator, am not doing anything. I'm not trying to silence my mind, and I don't have to do anything to enable the body to heal. Our bodies know how to heal if we give them the right conditions. That is deep rest. And then we can come back into balance and get rid of the byproduct of stress, which is anxiety. It's a biggie. Irritation, agitation, inability to settle, sadness. These are the big three. Some mania that also creates stress, but the big ones are fear and anger and sadness. And this is, you know, we're seeing this in epidemic proportions in our society. And my message is that is not your normal baseline. That's not who you are, and we can do something about it. But we need to do the opposite of what happened when you gained stress. We get stressed through pressure and overload and excitation. Meditation allows us to do the opposite. And so then the body can come back to homeostasis. We can come back to balance.
You know, when you're talking there about fear, anger, and sadness, with the exception of sadness, I am thinking that the way that one acts in a state of fear is something that gets glamorized in the workplace. Same with anger, in that when you were talking there about being agitated and being on the go, like I have some of my most productive days when I can't sit still. And so I'll think, yeah, I had a great day today. But even you just describing it like that makes me think, oh, maybe that wasn't the great day I thought it was, because I could not sit still. In my own company, you know, it's like, oh, as soon as I sat down, I'm up to do this, or, oh, is that a cobweb? That kind of headspace, yeah. Or, oh, I haven't sent that email. And these are things that listening to you, I realize I need to be de-excited, but in the modern world, they probably fall under the bracket of fear and or anger. And it's a reaction to those things. And yet I'm like, good, that's great. Not, oh, no, pay attention to that. Maybe sit down and meditate.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't want the message to be that meditation turns you into sort of some zoned out bliss bunny, you know, who's there on the sofa and, you know, hey man, I'm so chilled, it's all fine, you know, walk all over me. You know, what I witness is meditation creates a baseline state that allows you to be very dynamic, very, very engaged. That's what we want in life, you know. However, what I think you're pointing to there is engagement that is coming from a place that is not so stable. It's actually reactive. You know, stress reaction is a reaction. Oh, there's a demand. Oh, I've got to deal with that. Oh, here's something else. Oh, what about that? What about that? Or maybe that. And then we get into speculation mode, which is a classic sign. This is what fear is. Worry about the imaginary future. And what are we not doing? Well, we're not tuned into the very real present. You know, This is what stress does. It stretches the consciousness. It's like driving along in a car and I'm either looking in the rearview mirror, oh, why did I do that? And he shouldn't have said that. And I wish I'd said that. And, you know, we're beating ourselves up and going over old ground in the past. That's looking in the rearview mirror. Or we're imagining, oh, what if that happens? You know, what's coming around the corner? And, but if he does that, and I need to do that. But it's like the motorboat, you know, with the, what is, and what's happening? There could be a blooming great big pothole right in front of you in there, but you don't see it because consciousness is stretched in something that's already happened or something that may or may not happen.
Mm.
And the present moment is the future in the making. If we're not here, then where are we? We're either going over old ground or we are trying to intellectually work out what's going to happen, and it won't work. So meditation, you know, people talk about mindfulness. Mindfulness is great. Mindfulness is an outcome of meditation. I can be present, and then I will be present to what is the most relevant thing. And maybe the cobweb can wait, because actually what's really present right now is picking up on some idea that keeps bugging me, that actually I just need to get down on paper and I really need to sort of explore this. And I'm just going to, you know, workshop this on a piece of paper for the next 10 minutes because it keeps coming to me. But if I'm like, you know, antsy and out of balance and I'm reactive, then I'm going to be scattered, and my ability to put my attention on that which is most evolutionary and what is really relevant in the present moment drops through the floor. And then we find ourselves, oh yeah, I was busy, tick lots of things off my list. I remember a woman coming along to learn to meditate years ago, and she was one of these people who lived by her to-do list. Now, I love lists, by the way. I have a list. Lists are fine. But this woman was somebody who, she had her own business. She had three kids, I think, a very busy husband. It was all go, go, go. She came along and she learned to meditate. And on about day three of the course, she came back to me in a sort of mild state of panic. And she said, I didn't get anything on my list done today. I was like, oh, okay. And I said, well, so what did you do? What happened? And she said, well, actually, I picked up my daughter, and she had some sort of special needs. And we were just driving along, and I saw this place, and I've seen it a few times. And they offer these sort of classes and these art sort of therapy, I think it was. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to stop. And let's just go in. And I had my daughter with me, and we went in, and we ended up sitting there meeting one of the facilitators, and I signed my daughter up, and she just had this most amazing afternoon, and I stayed with her, and she's going to do these classes every week, you know? And I said, oh, okay. Yeah, sounds great. You know, it wasn't on her list. It was not on the list. Was it the most important evolutionary life-supporting thing to be doing with her daughter in that moment? Yes, absolutely, clearly, because she was paying attention. There it was, did it. But she was somebody who was so blinkered, and her modus operandi for life was, okay, you know, next thing, next thing, next thing. One from the outside would look at that person and think she's highly efficient, she's very organized, she's a doer, she's getting on with it. Okay. Yes, on one level. At what cost? You know, what's the opportunity cost of being like that and not being able to see what is actually the most sparkly, relevant thing in that moment?
It's a good point. It brings me back to my most hated word, which is should.
Yeah.
Even though I fall into that so often, or I think, oh, I should do that this week. And then I have to think, but that means that you're not doing anything that you would like to do or that you need to do. Should is, I really can't stand the word should.
It's a real warning sign. You know, if you find should in your vocabulary a lot, we need to pay attention. Yeah.
Let's talk about consciousness and relationships, because I found this to be a really interesting part of the book. And actually, even this morning, I had someone email me saying that they were struggling with friendships and relationships, and they felt like they'd set really poor boundaries. And I can definitely relate to that as well. But there is a section in the book about how meditation can actually support and enhance the bonds that you have with other people, whether it's friendship or romantic. Or could you explain that to me, please?
Meditation will change what it is that you bring to relationships. Now, a relationship is a function of what it is that we feed into the relationship. So two people, let's do the classic kind of, here's this person and this person. Let's do a lovey-dovey kind of relationship. So, but it applies to every relationship. So this person is coming in with their history, their everything, and this person's coming in with this, and their state of consciousness, their level of awareness, their neediness, their tension, their creativity, all of that, and this person with theirs. And they come together. And in relationship, we create, there's like a third being, there's a personality. This relationship is a function of these two people and what they bring to it. Often we'll think about relationships as what we're getting. Relationships are a function of what we give. So if someone goes into a relationship and they're 90% stressed and 10% fulfilled, let's not be surprised at what that relationship looks like. If I go into the relationship and I'm on the take, and what about me? And I feel needy, and I feel like in order for me to be happy, I need all of these things, and I need this person to do this and put the toothpaste there and, you know, remember to do all this stuff, and then I'll be happy. Yeah. So my happiness state, my fulfillment state, is contingent upon lovable other doing things the way I want them to be done. Then we know where that's going. You know, that relationship is not destined for longevity, or if it is, it's going to be pretty bumpy. When we go into a relationship and we are present and we're able to listen and we're happy, we have a baseline level of fulfillment there, we're not stressy, we're not dependent upon somebody else to get us through, you know, and adapt for us. We can meet demands ourselves, to know that we have a baseline. It's not that we don't want to have people help us, but that we have a level of baseline self-sufficiency. Then what I come into and bring to that relationship is valuable. And there's this basic principle in life, you know, what you give, you will receive. As you sow, so shall you reap. And it is so important to relationships. You want kindness, give kindness. You want attention, give attention. And that is very hard to do when you don't feel well and you feel overwhelmed and you feel emotionally out of balance and you're just off and you're fatigued and all of that. That doesn't help us step up into a relationship and bring to it something of value. The most valuable thing you can do for the people around you is to take care of yourself. Sometimes mums will come to me and they'll say, you know, I feel a bit selfish about taking some time to go and meditate. And I'm like, whoa, stop. You know, because if you are going into that, you know, relationship with your child and you're snappy and you're not so patient and you're not even able to listen to them and tune into the subtle cues that are there, and you're, you know, not so happy, then that's what you're modeling. And that is the least generous thing that you can be doing for that child. When you can go into that relationship and be present and be happy and grounded and conscious, awake, that is the most valuable thing that you can give that person, that interaction. So relationships will fundamentally change as a result of us being in a more balanced, healthy, energetic, creative, happy state. And we then lose that neediness. It's so much of relationship in this modern age comes from a place of neediness. And that leads to controlling behavior. It leads to mothering behavior, which is also a form of controlling. And women are doing this all the time, sort of mothering their partner. And it's a form of control. And it comes from a place actually of their own instability and lack. And then they look for it in others. Oh, well, when I get that person, and when then I'll be happy. The whole soulmate thing, And as I talk about in the book under the section about happiness, we live in an age where happiness, it's all about acquisition of experiences, acquisition of people, acquisition of education, acquisition of stuff, particularly money. And you get all that, and then I've got it. And it doesn't work. I meet many, many people who've got all that and they're miserable. Because they've worked out actually that all that stuff doesn't deliver a baseline level of fulfillment. Fulfillment is a self-referral experience. That baseline of bliss is in here. All those experiences, holidays, shoes, whatever, fantastic. Peak moments of a little flash of happiness, great, fine. I'm not saying we should all sort of, not have those things that generate some moments of pleasure, fine, but know them for what they are. And I think a lot of problems, a lot of challenges with relationships come from this position of looking for the lovable other, let's say, to fill a gap. And only ultimately can we really take care of our state of consciousness and our sense of well-being. Because then when that lovable other continues to evolve and change and maybe isn't continuing the behaviors that they did in the first 6 months, then in comes the controlling behavior and the expectations aren't being met and there's all the disappointment and the whole thing, gets a little bit messy. So yeah, relationships, it's all about what we bring to them.
And you're absolutely right. It's making me think about my first ever relationship and I was so heartbroken. But in truth, and it took years to really see this, the benefit of hindsight, realizing that what was so heartbreaking was that all of the things I knew I wasn't, he was. And so I thought, well, if I was his girlfriend, then I would be complete. And obviously that is not the way it works.
No.
I also wanted to ask you about yoga and meditation, because they are often seen to go hand in hand or seem to be extremely complementary. And I definitely, so in the evening when I finish work here, I'm working from home, have been for a while. Obviously, we're all doing it again now. But the way that I find I can end my working day is to do a bit of yoga and then a bit of guided meditation, and it just takes the edge off. Are they complementary? Do they need to be done in tandem? What do you advise at the meditation centers?
Yeah, I mean, yoga comes from the same body of knowledge. The Vedic knowledge comes from the Veda. So in the West, what we think of as yoga is basically, moving the body into certain positions, asanas. So that's working at the level of the physiology primarily, although it's having an effect in terms of prana, the breathing, energy flow in the body. And it will then have an effect in terms of mental state, because as I was saying, as is the mind, so is the body, as is the body, so is the mind. So it works in both directions. They're very complementary. They are not essential in the sense for a meditation perspective, in that, most of the people that I teach are not yogis. It's not like, one would think, oh, meditation, they're going to all be, yoga bunnies and, walking around in lycra. It's not actually the case at all. It's pretty much a lycra free zone. Interestingly, I would say many in that world have got a certain idea about, and have certain training around meditation. Actually, the people that we're teaching in our centers are from all walks of life. I'm a big fan of yoga when it's taught well, and I think it has a really important effect in terms of balancing the nervous system, and really keeping the system at a very deep level in balance. It's fantastic. So yeah, it's fine. It's not something that one needs to do in order to practice Vedic meditation. We do teach some particular asanas that go very well with the meditation practice when we do them just prior to, and it really enhances the purification. And it leads to all sorts of secondary benefits like flexibility and all of that. But it's a really important means of assisting with this de-excitation of the mind and settling down and transcending. So yeah, wonderful, but not necessary.
Now, I know that our time together is drawing to a close, and I could ask you 1,000 more questions. But the one thing I do want to finish on, actually, is I wanted to ask you about exercise, because I remember Madonna saying this back when she was doing the Blonde Ambition tour back in the 90s, when she would go on her runs in Hyde Park and she would say, running is my meditation. And I used to run a lot and I used to say the same thing. And I remember someone saying to me, you know why that is? It's because all your brain can focus on is breathing in, breathing out, and moving your legs and basically moving your body. And it did used to silence the stresses of the day that I was about to go into. But I think there's a really valuable point to be made, and I know you make it so well, about the fact that a distracting activity, which essentially what exercise is, or a jigsaw, and is not the same as meditation.
Yeah, you know, so if, you know, we're coming back to the sort of the wave analogy, settling down on the ocean, running around Hyde Park at full bore for, you know, an hour is not de-exciting the wave on the ocean. You know, it is basically the opposite, which is stress reactivity. You know, the body's like, where's the beer? Where's the beer? You know, oh God, run, run, run. And so what is happening psychophysiologically is excitation. And, you know, yes, the body sort of stops thinking about the mind stops thinking about the mortgage and all that sort of stuff, because, oh, you know, and this is why people say, oh yeah, I can really clear my mind. You know, I just tune out, you know, it's running's my meditation. I hear it all the time. I'm like, well, yeah, your mind is clearing out because your mind can't deal with the little birdies, you know, when it's face to face with a saber-toothed cat. It's all about this. And that's what the body is sort of doing when that extended process of running like that. It is not rest. It is not de-excitation. It is not experiencing that baseline of consciousness. It is running. And the reason, but what it's doing is it's also pumping out a biochemistry that is meditation-like, in that it's pumping out the endorphins, and the endorphins are there to mitigate against the feeling of discomfort and pain in the body, to allow us to keep running away from the tiger or whatever it is. So, you know, we can feel that sort of the runner's high and that good feeling. It feels, and there's a biochemical response in the body to this, same as there's a biochemical response in the body when we sit on the tube and we close our eyes and we meditate. The body starts to normalize dopamine, and it starts to pump up the serotonin levels, and all that's happening naturally. So there's that parallel as well that I often hear, but it's a very different mind-body experience than sitting in the chair and resting five times deeper than sleep. And it's having an effect on one's body and joints and all of that. So there's all that stuff to deal with. Exercise is great. When it's done in a way that works for your mind body type, and when we do it at the right time of the day and all of that, there's a whole lot that we could talk about there, in this whole area of Ayurveda, which is another big area of my training. So yeah, but this idea that running is my meditation, no. You know, what someone said to me that day, cooking, you know, cooking is my meditation. No, it's not. Cooking is cooking. It might be very enjoyable, but it's not meditation.
I do enjoy a methodical task when I just need to switch off, but that I understand that that's not the same as meditation. If you're cutting carrots with a sharp knife, you need to have your mind on that, because there is an element of danger there. If you're not paying attention, you could cut yourself. How does it compare to a flow state?
A flow state as in a yoga flow state, or
a flow state in the idea that when you're in a flow state, when you basically it's getting into the groove and time kind of disappears, and before you know it, 5 hours have passed because you've been, I don't know, fixing an old watch or something.
Well, I think what you're describing there is the ability to be present, you know, as opposed to, oh, there's the cobweb and there's that and there's this and there's that, and we're all over the, you know, there's the ricochet rabbit. We're sort of very reactive. And then there's something really sort of a blessed relief. Oh, all I have to do is chop the carrots. You know, it's like, ah, all that noise, all that, I don't need to deal with that right now. I can just go here. And that relief for the mind and the body, just here, is a counterbalance to the normal sort of overload that's going on, the normal noise that's happening. What I would say is that focus is good, and we are able to have a state of consciousness which allows us to focus, and yet not at the expense of everything else that's going on around us. We don't lose the perspective by only being able to do this. It's like, oh, okay, I can only do this if I do this. And this is consciousness. You know, consciousness is a quantity. So if I can only handle this much in my awareness, I only have this much consciousness, then whatever I'm doing here, yep, I've got it. It's a really big deal. What we want is we want to have a wider angle lens on the camera. We want more consciousness, the ability to pick up more things. I can still zero in on the carrots if I need to. They're going to be beautifully chopped. And yet I can still see that that kid's about to kick a football over there, and I might just move that cup because, oh, I can see, you know, I have access to more in my awareness. And this is ultimately what meditation is doing. It's expanding our consciousness. And then we have the capacity to take in more at one time, and we can see cause and effect. Oh, that's happening because of that. And he's behaving like that because of that thing over there. And that, and it's all connected. If my consciousness is so skinny that all I can handle is this, oh, all right, no, okay, now I'll do this, then it's quite limiting.
You're describing seeing the Matrix. Basically, you do your four sessions with you, Jillian, and you're Neo, you're the one, and then it's all gravy. I honestly, I could talk to you for another 4 hours easily, and I think a lot of I wonder if this is true, that most of the conversations that you have with people are people verbalizing some form of resistance to it before they'll leap. Does that happen? People saying, but does it work? How do I do it? I can't do it. Is there a lot of can'ts? And are there a lot of can'ts in people's conversation when they come to you, because obviously they've come to you for a specific reason, but do you find that you're having to sort of sell it or pitch it quite a lot because people are just assuming that they can't?
There is that, although I think that people self-select. There's a self-selection that goes on, you know. So every week, Michael and I are giving, you know, a one-hour introductory talk on Zoom. There are millions of people around. How many people are coming to those, you know, tippy-tip-tip-tip-tip top of the pyramid, you know? And it's a question of readiness. You know, I talk about meditation all the time. I'm like a walking introductory talk, you know. Is everybody going to learn to meditate? No. And that's a function of their state of consciousness, their readiness. And I respect where everybody's at. And so I think, you know, what I recognize with that is it's not my role to kind of convert people. It's not my role to try to give somebody something that they're not ready for, because I'll ultimately be the one that gets bruised. And this is a really good principle for us to remember in life. You know, don't give somebody something that they don't feel they deserve or that they don't want or that they're not ready for. And that could be information, it could be love, it could be anything, because it will come back and bite you. So what I'm looking for is, what's the conscious receptivity? You know, you and I are having this conversation. There are, you know, many people that could be interviewing me. You had the awareness and the interest and the state of consciousness to say, ah, this is something that I'm really curious about. I want to know more about. I want to share this with my audience. And so that puts you at the front of the wave. And so we end up having this wonderful conversation. Not everybody's at the front of the wave, and we just have to accept that. But it's not the best use of my time to try and get everybody to that place. You know, I had a woman once, she came along to one of our talks, didn't say that much, and we never heard from her again. I thought, okay, fine, yeah, it happens all the time. 7 years later, she sends an email, she goes, I'm ready now. She came along with the list, like, great, fine. You know, we're all ready when we're ready. And so, you know, we're here and we love talking about the stuff and we love teaching it, but I'm not standing out there, you know, with one of those sandwich boards going, hey, mantras, get over in here, you know. The best way that I can move this forward and add value to this whole conversation and assist people is to support those that are showing those signs of being ready. And if you are, and there's something about this resonates, something about this feels at some level, this is interesting, I really can feel that there's something, then continue that research. You know, come to one of the talks, read a book, talk to somebody. You know, we live in an age now where there's so much that's available. You know, I would say you're onto it. You know, keep going, keep checking this out. And of course, you know, we'd love to see anybody who feels, I'm ready to take that next step on that journey.
Well, with that in mind, would you let listeners know where they can find you? And is it just for people who can go to the centres, or can they learn from you via Zoom, given that we're in a more of an online situation these days?
We are purists when it comes to this. So we are teaching this knowledge in the way that it was taught hundreds, thousands of years ago. So to learn Vedic meditation from us, we're not going to cut corners on this. This is, as I said earlier, the most important thing you will ever do. So we have to have that in-person moment. We're teaching at the moment. We're teaching here and in New York. We're teaching with masks. We're socially distanced. It's all very safe. And we'll see. We're monitoring that very closely because things are changing day by day. So we need to stay on it and adaptable with that. LondonMeditationCentre.com, NewYorkMeditationCentre.com, JillianLavender.com. I'm teaching actually first retreat that I'm doing for new meditators. Anyone that wants to come and learn is in Portugal, 12th of January. And you can come and stay with me in Casa Fuseta, this beautiful villa in Portugal. And I'm going to teach people to meditate. That's going to be a wonderful immersive experience. The next step, come and, you know, do one of our free introductory talks on Zoom, or get the book. People are really enjoying that as a way of kind of moving along on the path. Or send me an email. You know, I love chatting, love to hear from people. But the websites are probably best, and then obviously with social media.
Well, listeners, I will put all of the links to everything that Gillian just mentioned in the show notes. But this has been such a pleasure and a delight. Thank you so much for your time. It's been so good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I appreciate your time hugely. If you did enjoy it and you never want to miss an episode, then please do hit the subscribe button wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. It's also where you get the opportunity to leave a 5-star review and a rating for how you feel about the show. And I'd be so grateful if you wouldn't mind leaving one. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Gunns. If you fancy chatting to me and thousands of other fellow listeners of the podcast, then click the link to join the Facebook forum. The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode.
You have to answer a couple of questions, but we cannot wait to see you there. Come over and join the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.